the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, discrimination in almost every institution of our lives. You know, that casts a long shadow, and that's still part of our DNA. That's passed on. We're not cured of it.
Racism.
We are not cured of it.
Clearly.
And it's not just a matter of it not being polite to say nigger in public. That's not the measure of whether racism still exists or not.
President Obama, talking to Mark Maron on his WTF podcast released today, the killing of 9 African Americans at the Emmanuel AME Church last week has launched another discussion about race and racism in America. As Trey just mentioned, it has also initiated another round of questions about the symbolism of the Confederate flag. Republican presidential contenders were asked over the weekend if the flag should be removed from its place on the grounds of the South Carolina State Capitol. Here's what Mike Huckabee, Bobby Jindal, and Rick Santorum had to say.
Are you comfortable displaying the Confederate battle flag in public?
I don't personally display it anywhere, so it's not an issue for me, and so that's an issue for the people of South Carolina.
Those are decisions best made at the state level.
It's an issue that South Carolina needs to deal with, and again, I don't know all the complexities of how that was decided.
Well, the decision does seem to be changing today. South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley is expected to announce next hour that she will call for the flag's removal. Josh Kraushauer is political editor for the National Journal, and he joins us now. Welcome back, Josh.
Thanks, Madeline.
Why is it so hard for Republican candidates to just say yes or no on this question, remove it or don't remove it?
Well, it's politics as usual, and the fact that there's a big primary in South Carolina, the third primary on the Republican presidential calendar, and you still have not a large segment of the Republican electorate, but a significant one that might look at a certain Republican candidate unfavorably if they said that they took the lead in saying that the Confederate flag should be taken down. So, you know, you pointed to comments by Mike Huckabee, Bobby Jindal, Rick Santorum, who were very cautious, that said it was up to the states, but you also saw more candidates with perhaps less to lose, like a Jeb Bush, a Marco Rubio. Jeb Bush took the Confederate flag down from Florida, in Florida when he was governor. They also, you know, were a little cautious as well. They didn't follow the lead of Governor Haley and some other South Carolina politicians who will be announcing that they are calling for the flag to be taken down of their home state. So this is political caution, and the fact that South Carolina plays such a pivotal role on the Republican presidential calendar really fueled that caution from candidates that otherwise would probably say just take the flag down.
Well, speaking of, let's hear from Senator Lindsey Graham. He is from South Carolina. He is running for president. And his take was a little more nuanced. Here's what he had to say.
To revisit that decision would be fine with me, but this is part of who we are. The flag represents to some people a civil war, and that was the symbol of one side. To others, it's a racist symbol, and it's been used by people. It's been used in a racist way. But the problems we have in South Carolina throughout the world are not because of a movie or a symbol. It's because of what's in people's heart.
So he's not coming down one way or the other. Is it pretty convenient that they're saying we'll leave it up to the state lawmakers to make this decision?
Well, it's actually very timely. Lindsey Graham just came out this afternoon saying that the flag should be taken down. So he flip-flopped.
Good.
He changed his position in the last 24 hours, which shows you where the political momentum is among Republicans in calling for the flag to be taken down. And it looks like the South Carolina governor and the South Carolina state legislature are moving towards doing just that. But, you know, the fact that the Republican presidential candidates, nearly every one of them, expressed such caution, and ranging from saying it's a state's issue to just not being as explicit as they otherwise could have been. Like, Mitt Romney even was very explicit over the weekend, saying that the flag should be taken down. But you didn't see that from any of the Republican presidential candidates. And now you are. Now it took a couple days, but the fact that Governor Haley is now leading that momentum in her home state, I think you're seeing a sea change now with Republican public opinion. And the fact that Lindsey Graham said those comments you just played and now is changing his very tune is indicative of how things have changed so fast.
Right. So he made those comments yesterday. And so did he change his mind after Governor Haley decided to ask for the flag's removal?
The exact timing is a little uncertain, but Governor Haley, it was reported earlier today that she was is going to be calling for the flag to be taken down at a 4 o'clock Eastern press conference. And like clockwork, both Senator Graham and Senator Scott, who is African-American and is also a Republican, is also agreeing with her decision. And they're both going to be making public comments this afternoon.
Right. So what's got to happen next? The state lawmakers need to actually make the decision, right?
Right. And we're hearing some Republicans from the state legislatures, the state house, that are starting to say just that. And the governor has a big role in persuading and lobbying members of her own party to do so. So this might become a non-issue in a couple days if South Carolina does do what it has taken so long for it not for. There's been public pressure in the past, even during the 2000 presidential campaign with John McCain and George W. Bush clashing over the Confederate flag. And it became a tricky issue for McCain in that presidential primary. This is not something that's not the first time we've been talking about this. But it looks like for the first time, the momentum is there for that flag to come down.
Right, right. You mentioned John McCain, and obviously he's a good friend of Senator Graham's as well. And he wrote in a book that that was one of the worst decisions of his career not to have called for the flag's removal.
It's stunning how many former Republican politicians, John McCain, in his book, Mitt Romney, who eventually came out for the flag to be taken down when he was running for president, but it was also took some time. It's usually the folks that don't have as much skin in the game. And again, the South Carolina presidential primary could be extremely consequential this year, given the wide open nature of the contest and given the fact that it could be a tiebreaker of sorts, or could really anoint a front runner in the presidential field. So the fact that every candidate didn't want to alienate a potential constituency by tailoring their remarks the way they did, it was very telling, and they needed some political cover from Governor Haley and other Republican officials from the state before they start doing so.
Yeah. Well, African Americans don't normally vote Republican, and so how important was the vote for them?
I mean, this is an important issue not just for African Americans, but it's you look at the polling, and an overwhelming number of Americans are opposed to seeing the Confederate flag on the state capitol grounds. The only exception is, and even among Southern whites, which is where the constituency we're talking about, even it is pretty evenly divided. So this is not like there's an overwhelming constituency for keeping the Confederate flag up. So it's more about the Republican brand and showing that they can be tolerant and showing that their image can not be affected by having an issue like this take over. And I think those elements of the party won over this short debate. And that's why you're seeing folks like Lindsey Graham, who were sort of hedging their bets a couple days ago, now being much more open and saying that the flag should come down.
Right. And how much of a political siren call should this be for the Democrats? I mean, should they, once this is decided and the flag is taken down, are they going to just let it go, or do you think that this will be an issue that will be brought up as the campaign progresses?
I mean, politically speaking, they're trying to mobilize the base, and it's certainly an issue that you mentioned African Americans. They're certainly very attuned to the issue. And Hillary Clinton gave a speech in San Francisco this weekend talking about race and how it was still an unsolved challenge in the country. So she needs to turn out a lot of her base voters to the polls. It's an issue that resonates with them, certainly. And I don't think for her own political, given her own political circumstances, that she and other Democratic presidential candidates are going to stop talking about this. But, after if the flag is taken down, if the South Carolina legislature does go ahead with that, I don't know how much more political momentum or political hay there will that will be able to be made out of this incident.
Josh Krasshauer, political editor for the National Journal. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Madeline.
Well, even if you don't like the Confederate flag, do you agree with the Republican candidates that it really should be an issue decided by the states and not something that should come down from the federal government? Or tell us what you think about this issue and the race in general. If you'd like to weigh in on the presidential race, we'd love to hear from you. Our Twitter is at KCRW Press Play. Our Facebook is KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, Supreme Court decisions involving the California raisins and whether L.A. police officers can inspect hotel registries anytime they want. Also, why do judges rarely say, "I'm sorry, I was wrong"? Those stories are next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles police are not allowed to randomly search guest registries at the city's hotels and motels. That's one of the decisions that came out today from the Supreme Court. The justices also handed down rulings involving California raisin farmers and Marvel. David Savage covers the court for the LA Times. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's talk about the police decision. The city had adopted a law that was supposed to fight prostitution, gambling, drug trafficking by allowing police officers to randomly search registries. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. That's unreasonable search and seizure?
Yes, the Supreme Court basically said the law is too broad, that for any reason or no reason, a police officer at any time, day or night, could go into a motel and said, I want to see your motel registry. And I guess there were a number of motel owners around town who were, the family runs the motel, and they were complaining that, you know, officers would come in 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night, and they asked for some limit. And the Supreme Court basically agreed that you have to have some, the motel owners have a right to object and say that, what's the justification for this? And to take the issue before a judge. And so it appears that the LA is going to have to come back and pass some new law that makes it clear that some judge has to approve this before there's this, you know, sort of spot searches can go forward.
And this was a 5-4 decision. What was the dissent? What did they argue?
Well, Justice Scalia was of the view that this was not a matter of sort of private property. This is not a matter of the police coming into your house. That this is, you're running a business, you have these records, and Scalia said, we'd said in the past that business records are subject to search. So he would have viewed it as a matter of, this is just a matter of business records. It's not a matter of personal property. So these kinds of searches, he said, are reasonable.
Right. And I guess the police are saying, look, this is really going to hamper us in our efforts to fight crime.
Yes, and I can't say I know it well enough to judge that, Madeline. I remember when this case came up that the LAP was, the Ninth Circuit had struck down this law, yeah. And the LAPD said this is a big problem because a lot of these motels are used for prostitution. They said sex trafficking, drugs, and that they wanted to be able to move quickly and go in and sort of check to see who was there and who was registered, and they needed this authority. So as I say, the only thing that they're going to happen now is that the city attorney is going to have to go back and try to come up with a new ordinance.
All right, moving on to a case involving California raisin farmers. This one's a bit confusing, but it involves a Depression-era government program designed to help the farmers, but the court ruled that this is an unconstitutional taking of private property. What happened?
It is an unusual program, I'm told, in the sense that if you grow raisins, the board basically gets together, and they're all people that you support. A majority of the growers support the board, and they say, in years when we've got a glut of raisins, we're going to require you to set aside 20% of your crop, a quarter of your crop, and hold it, keep it off the market, for the idea of that'll prop up the price. And one grower, Marvin Horn, objected out in Fresno and said, he thought it was not helping him much. He disagreed with the whole theory. He said they're basically taking a quarter of my crop, a third of my crop, giving it away overseas or giving it to school lunch programs. He sued, and the Supreme Court basically said, when the government takes your property, it's unconstitutional, and they have to pay you for it. So basically, after a very long legal fight, they're going to say this fellow's entitled to be paid for all the raisins that were taken from him.
Even though he was maybe making more money by the prices being higher because there was less supply.
Correct. In fact, Justice Breyer and some of the liberal justices said, even if I can agree with you in theory that there may have been something taken from him, shouldn't you go back and calculate how much he benefited from the higher prices? But the five conservative justices said, Mr. Horn wins, he deserves compensation, and you don't need to go back and calculate how much he benefited from the program.
And he, Mr. Horn, was backed by some conservative groups in this. So is this part of a larger ideological battle?
Yes, it sure is. And it's hard to know how it's going to play out, but there's been a long fight in a lot of areas over what's a government regulation and what's a taking. In other words, if you have a house, the government can impose a zoning rule and say you can't build a 10-story apartment on your property because that's a regulation. They can limit your property. But on the other hand, the court will say, but they can't take it from you entirely. And so a lot of private property rights activists have been arguing for a stronger view that says you need to act when the government really is taking your property, in this case, taking your personal property, not allowing you to use it. And so this ruling is one of those ones that will play down the road in some area. Could be home mortgages or something, where the courts are going to say the government may not regulate this way because they're really taking private property.
Hmm. Well, I wonder if it might be used in the fight against high-speed rail here in California and eminent domain.
I think that's a very good guess. I mean, this is one of these things when the Supreme Court says this, it's very hard to know down the road how it's going to be used. But yes, it's a ruling that strengthens private property rights against government regulation.
Okay, finally, the court weighed in on a fight between a toy maker and Marvel. And tell us about this case.
Well, this is a situation where a young Mr. Kimball had come up with a little toy that was like a Spider-Man toy. And it was really a question of patent law. Everybody agreed that Mr. Kimball, the maker, was entitled to royalties for 20 years. But Marvel said, after 20 years, even though we'd agreed to pay royalties indefinitely, you can't make us pay after 20 years because that's how long the patent lasts. And Mr. Kimball went to the Supreme Court and said that's basically unfair, but the 6-3 majority upheld the old rule that your right to get patent royalties expires at the end of your patent life, which was, in this instance, as I say, was 20 years.
So he's out of luck.
He's out of luck going forward.
Okay. Was this about anything larger than this particular case, or does it just reaffirm U.S. copyright and patent law?
It reaffirms the old patent law. Mr. Kimball wanted the court to strike down some of its precedents and say this was unfair. He had made this deal. The company was still making money. But basically a 6-3 majority said, sorry, 20 years is the rule, and we're sticking with it.
Okay, and we're still waiting on the big decisions. So any idea when we're going to get those, gay marriage, Affordable Care Act?
I would guess it's going to be Monday or Tuesday or next week, but they said they're going to have opinions on Thursday and Friday and then presumably Monday and or Tuesday of next week, and that will be somewhere in one of those days.
Okay, so we have till the end of June.
Correct.
All right. David Savage covers the U.S. Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, now that Raisins and Spider-Man are out of the way, the Supreme Court can focus on some of the bigger cases to grace the docket. Gay marriage, the death penalty, health care. The justices are seeking to answer some of the biggest questions of our time. But what if they get it wrong? What happens if years later they find that they erred in their judgment? Emily Bazelon has written about that issue for the New York Times Magazine, where she's a staff writer. Welcome to the program, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, nice to have you again. And you write about your grandfather. He was a federal appeals court judge, and his name was David Bazelon. And he did something that most judges never do, and that is he publicly changed his mind. Can you tell us about that case?
Yeah, sure. The story starts in 1954 with a defendant named Monty Durham. He broke into a house, and then it turned out he had a long history of mental illness. He'd been hospitalized, he'd been discharged from the Navy, and he tried to plead insanity. The standard at that time for pleading insanity was very high, and some states still use it today, but essentially a defendant had to prove that he didn't know right from wrong and really didn't know what he was doing at all. And my grandfather worried that this was was too high a bar, and he wanted psychiatrists to come in and give very replete, full testimony about a defendant's mental condition. His essential concern was about moral blameworthiness and trying to figure out why people who are accused of crimes commit them and whether they should be held responsible. So he came up with this new rule, which was about whether the criminal conduct was the product of a mental condition or defect. And he hoped that psychiatrists would shed light with testimony on this question. Then over the next 18 years, to his frustration, the testimony he was hoping to see just really didn't materialize. Psychiatrists remained very polarized and kind of conclusory in their testimony. And so he finally, with the rest of his court, decided that his rule just wasn't going to work. And so it's really an example of a judge looking at the consequences of his ruling over time, seeing that the ruling had unintended effects, and then changing his mind.
Well, why is it that that doesn't happen more often? Because, of course, the world changes and facts change and, you know, people's opinions change. Just look at gay marriage as a prime example. So why is it that judges and justices seem loath to actually change their minds and do so in public?
You know, we rely on the law fundamentally for stability. And so if judges kind of willy-nilly shake things up and change things, then you worry that people are not going to be able to rely on the rule of law as they make choices, both individually and in terms of, you know, investments for business. There are all kinds of ways in which stability is really important. But then, of course, you're right. Times do change. And the Supreme Court, in particular, since it's giving guidance to all the courts across the country, has to make some provision for changing its mind. You know, the most important example, perhaps, was the court's abandonment of the principle of separate but equal. Mm-hmm. That was the support for segregation that lasted for about 60 years. And finally, the court threw it out. And I don't think there's anyone or at least, you know, no justices on the Supreme Court today would argue that separate but equal should have stayed in place simply because that was the initial call the court made back in 1896.
But did any of the original justices on Plessy v. Ferguson admit that they were wrong?
I don't think that they did. And so what you're pointing to, I think, is that the usual process for change on the Supreme Court is that some justices make a decision and then they retire or they leave the court for other reasons. And then some new justices come along, you know, generations later, and with a lot of dignity, with a lot of decorum, they make the call to change things. What's much more unusual is for an individual justice or set of justices to say, hey, I got it wrong the first time, and here's why. Here's why I personally am changing my mind.
And you also write about in your article the fact that it's much more common for judges and justices to go, when they do change their minds, to move toward the left rather than the right, to become more liberal in their opinion rather than more conservative.
Right. This was a surprising finding to me, honestly, because there is no reason why in a kind of empirically based approach to judging would necessarily move you to the left. You could have a kind of liberal ruling that turned out to be misguided, and then the court could move to the right. And yet there is this pattern that I found, and law professors who have studied this have also seen the same thing, where when you see an individual justice changing his or her mind, it tends to be a shift to the left. And the example that came up a few times and is quite dramatic involves the death penalty. So there are three justices who cast important votes to uphold the death penalty who later said, you know what, this was a mistake. And the reasons they cited had to do with watching the courts over time try to administer the death penalty fairly and deciding that that just couldn't be done in a reliable manner.
Well, I guess it does come under the whole definition of what is a conservative and what is a liberal, because to be a conservative is to support the status quo, right? So it would seem logical that if you are going to change your mind, you would go more towards the left.
Right. That makes sense. But then there are major Supreme Court rulings, for example, Roe versus Wade, that conservative justices really don't like. I don't think there's any question that if Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas, for example, had a chance, they would decide to overturn Roe versus Wade, even though it's been the law of the land for more than 40 years. So the court as a whole has certainly moved to the right on major issues. Recently, Citizens United comes to mind as a big example of a move to the right that's a shift of the majority of the court as opposed to one individual justice changing his or her mind.
Well, then that brings up the question of whether or not this is about the justice's own personal beliefs or whether they are actually taking into account dispassionate facts to change their minds.
Right. And I was the most interested in looking at judges who are interested in consequences. So in other words, not having some personal epiphany, but looking at how a decision plays out on the ground over time. And one of my favorite examples is from the 1940s. There was a decision in which the court said that public schools could require students to say the Pledge of Allegiance and salute the flag. It was the beginning of the Second World War. The court talked about the importance of patriotism. It was not so interested in the claims of religious freedom brought by a Jehovah's Witness family who didn't want to salute or say the pledge because they saw that as a violation of their religious beliefs. Over the 3 years that followed that decision, there were attacks on Jehovah's Witnesses throughout the country. Mobs were burning down their places of worship, and a lot of kids got expelled from school. And three justices changed their minds. So 3 years later, the court said, we were wrong, we didn't anticipate the consequences of this decision, and we are going to issue the reverse ruling.
So how often do the justices take into consideration the practical effects of their ruling? So, you know, I'm thinking about the healthcare decision. Are they actually thinking, and we don't know what's going on in their minds, but are they thinking, like, what are the effects going to be if we find that those four little words mean more than people, the Congress thought they would, and they strike down Obamacare?
I think some of them are certainly taking effects into account, and this would be the analysis for doing that, that all the justices will start with the text of the law and these four words that suggest that at least in that line of the statute, Congress said that healthcare subsidies are only available through healthcare exchanges set up by the states. But if you look at the statute as a whole, it becomes clear, I think, and I'm sure some of the justices will agree, that Congress didn't really intend that when it was thinking about the workings of the law as a whole. And so if you care about context, if you think that that part of your job as a judge is to help the statute make sense when you read the whole thing together, then the consequences become really important. And in this case, we're talking about more than 6 million people across the country losing their health care subsidies. So the justices who are thinking in terms of context will be interested in that kind of a practical effect of their ruling.
I know. It's interesting to think that maybe it's Justice Roberts who could change his mind, you know, because he upheld the law in the previous decision and he might change his mind in this case.
Right. And there was reporting based on anonymous sources at the time that Chief Justice Roberts, when we had the first Obamacare case a couple of years ago, was disposed to strike down the Affordable Care Act. And then between oral argument and the time the decision came out, he changed his mind. And so now he is, at least among court watchers, seen as the swing vote potentially in this second case. If he were this time to side with the challengers and strike down this part of the law, it would be a shift from the public stance he took previously. So he is in a really interesting position. And my big question is, how much does he care about pragmatism and the practical effects of the court's ruling?
Well, Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. And you can find her latest piece. It's called Better Judgment at newyorktimes.com. Coming up on the program, it's multi-million-dollar artist versus multi-billion-dollar corporation, Taylor Swift versus Apple, and streaming music. That story after a news update with Steve Chiotakis.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It was Taylor Swift versus Apple over the weekend, and it looks like Taylor Swift won. Apple was planning to roll out its new music streaming service on June 30th with a three-month free trial, and the company was not planning to pay artists or labels during that time period. Well, T-Swift let her displeasure be known on her Tumblr page, saying it is not right to give music away without paying artists. 24 hours later, Apple relented. Joan Salzman writes about digital media for CNET. Welcome back, Joan.
Hi, thank you.
Well, what was her complaint? That she just thought it was blatantly unfair that she and other artists weren't getting paid?
Right, that's exactly it. And she has a valid point here. The way that Apple has set up their contracts was that artists and labels could have their catalog of music on their new streaming service, Apple Music, launching later this month. But during this free trial period, 3 months when consumers can listen to it as much as they want, all-you-can-eat buffet without having to pay so they can try it out, those artists and labels wouldn't get paid for any of that listening. Now, if you're a big artist like Taylor Swift, it's a big issue, but it's not that important to you in terms of dollar and cents. But if you're a smaller artist and you happen to have an album coming out within those 3 months, that could make or break you.
Well, why did the other big labels sign off on this?
Well, actually, there had been a lot of dissent from independent labels in the week leading up to Taylor's blog post over the weekend because of all the points you just mentioned. It's just that Taylor Swift, being the single biggest selling artist in a decade, has the biggest loudspeaker to really make it known. And Taylor Swift, she's such a big artist that Apple really couldn't do without her.
And she also had a similar battle with Spotify, and her music is not on Spotify.
That's right. She pulled out of Spotify last fall over some of the same complaints. In this instance, with Apple, they literally weren't going to be paying artists. The complaint around Spotify is that the model of subscription streaming music hasn't reached the point of scale to the point that artists actually get the kind of money that they would see in a CD era. With Apple, however, they literally would not be paid for an entire 3 months when the free trials were occurring.
So now Apple has relented, and how much money is it going to have to dole out?
You know, the thing about Apple is they have so much. Apple has $195 billion just sitting around. They could buy the entire music industry if they wanted to.
They could buy Greece if they wanted to.
They could buy countries. They have so much money. This wasn't an issue about paying out so much money for, it wasn't a prohibitive cost for them to be able to pay for this 3 month period. The issue was more of a negotiating tool. They told labels, hey, we'll pay you a little bit more after those 3 months, incrementally more percentage wise than other streaming services will, if you let us have this 3 months free. The fact that they capitulated so quickly, it shows the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, the cost associated with the decision, it's a rounding error for them. The cost of it isn't worth the bad press that they would get with all these indie labels protesting, all these indie labels choosing not to participate, and people like Taylor Swift saying Apple doesn't care about artists.
Why is Taylor Swift taking up this cause? I mean, as you said earlier, she doesn't really need to because she's already making tons of money.
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, Taylor Swift is somebody that comes from an independent background. She is a song maker and a songwriter, and I think she legitimately cares about this issue. That's not to say, of course, when her album released, when she really got the most attention for this, it was when her 1989 album was releasing, and that was around the same time that she pulled out of Spotify. She wanted to sell a lot of albums, and this was one way to get a lot of attention to how selling albums is important to artists like her, and she was incredibly successful. It was one of the best-selling albums in a decade. But I think that it's not just, it's equal measures. It's, she actually does, I think, care about what it means for artists because she considers herself an artist at heart, even if she is also this mega-selling brand in music as well.
So she's not getting the same kind of criticism that Jay-Z and all those other big artists like Madonna got when they unveiled Tidal, the streaming service that bills itself as the first artist-owned streaming service in the world. You know, people were saying, oh, great, we're going to give you even more money. You're already rich.
Right. I think that the difficulty with Tidal was that they just didn't realize exactly how it would come off to the mainstream consumer. When they launched Tidal, it felt like these billionaire artists were co-opting this rhetoric about how they need to be working for the little guy when they'd be charging people for a service that would be even more expensive. Ultimately, there's not a lot of difference between what the founders and the proponents of Tidal are doing with what Swift is doing. They're still making the same argument. A lot of this is PR.
Right. And professional photographers complained about Taylor Swift's double standard in this. They say that they have to let her use any pictures they shoot at her concerts for free.
Right. Well, I mean, this is where you get into trouble when you take up a populist cause, but not every way that you behave is in a populist manner, right? Of course, there's reasons why Taylor Swift, as this gigantic brand in entertainment, has lawyers that want to protect her interests, and they have these contracts for photographers to protect those interests and be the most beneficial to her as they can be. Ultimately, it's hard for anybody who's somebody like Taylor Swift to be completely populist, because ultimately she wants to make money. She wants to sell albums and get her art out there. So it's just a difficulty for sure if you're going to be taking up that rhetoric versus what you can actually do as somebody with those dual desires.
Joan Salzman, senior writer for CNET. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi there, Warren Olney.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm well. How
are
you?
Have you taken on any billion-dollar corporations lately?
I haven't done that for a while, no. But what we are going to take on is the issue of refugees around the world. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees has just released a report. We'll have the spokesperson for that agency talking to us from Europe. And if you only count the more recent of refugees from countries that are repressive or, in fact, engaged in civil war of some kind or where there is enormous violence, you get 60 million refugees worldwide. That's the largest number that's ever been recorded. And half of them, 30 million of them, are children.
That's incredible. Where are they going?
If you add in those from previous conflicts who don't always have to be counted by the UN, and particularly those who have fled countries for economic reasons, the number goes much higher, but nobody knows what it is. So the question is, what do we do about all of these people? You ask where they go. They're going, and often from poor countries to even poorer countries. So, for example, people are going from Darfur to Chad, according to one of our guests. Which, of course, makes things, you know, much worse than even the UN is reporting. And it's restricted in what it can report by various treaties that have been signed over the years. So there's no political will, apparently, at the UN or anyplace else, certainly not in Washington, to really tackle this issue. The last remaining superpower is not really doing its job in this regard, according to its critics.
Well, then the EU is also taking up the migrant crisis.
Yeah,
today.
But it's minute by comparison to the total. We're talking about 40,000 people or something like that, which is a lot of people. I don't mean to dismiss it in any way. But they can't generate the political will to deal with that many. So when you're talking 60 million worldwide, you're talking about a crisis, a humanitarian crisis.
Okay. Look forward to that important discussion coming up at 1 o'clock on To the Point.
Okay.
Warren Olney, thank you very much. And coming up on this program, HBO lost its zhuzh last night. Our TV critic says True Detective and Ballers disappointments. That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Summer, the open road, our national parks, relaxing on the beach with a good book. No, why bother when you have TV? And here for our weekly TV roundup is Sarah Mesley. She's humanities editor for the Los Angeles Review of Books, where she writes for the Dear Television column. Welcome back, Sarah.
I'm so glad to be here.
Nice to have you, because there was a big night last night on HBO.
Big night of television.
Right.
So much anticipation. So many soul for men. We're going to look at sad things, Madeline. The nation held its breath.
I know, for season 2 of True Detective.
True Detective.
All right, let's hear a clip.
Sometimes your worst self is your best self.
My strong suspicion is we get the world we deserve.
Okay. Do we deserve this show? Have we been that
what
naughty?
What did I do?
Have we been that bad?
What did I do to deserve this show, Madeline? Okay. So I thought the first season of True Detective was fairly ridiculous and at times deeply troubling, but also really entertaining. Like, that was a story that sucked everybody in, and we all got to talk about it, and we all had a lot of fun, and we argued about it.
We loved Matthew McConaughey and his
weird,
we
loved his cheekbones.
Rants.
Nothing has ever been taken as seriously on television as Matthew McConaughey's cheekbones, which were going to like reveal to us the deep philosophical depths of human nature, you know. And it was so pretty, and the story was so rich. And last night, I was excited for a new story to argue about, and we did not get one.
So give us the plot synopsis. Because to be honest, it's hard to discern exactly what was happening.
Of season two? Well, that would be the problem, right? So there's, instead of two characters, as in season one, solving a crime that sort of seems to reach into this sort of gothic Louisiana mystery, there's four characters who have different relationships to what seems to be a corruption plot about mismanagement of public funds, perhaps around a transportation route or pollution in some way.
But it involves Vernon, right? I mean, it's
right.
supposed to be based on
yes,
Vernon.
A hypothetical Vernon, California, called yeah. Vinci. But it was really, I found it hard to follow. I found the shots that were supposed to be pretty boring rather than pretty. You know, I guess they're these detectives and they have to solve a crime and they have to find out which particular corrupt politician murdered somebody in a brutal way that teaches them the darkness of the world. But I already know that some corrupt, you know, like just by the nature of it, like
and we don't
some,
really know what the crime is.
You know,
for a long
some
time.
Bad person did a bad thing, you know, like men will look at it sadly. You know, I mean, I guess I would say I'm not, you know, I will keep watching. Taylor Kitsch of Friday Night Lights is in it and he has short hair now. So his like deep tortured soul is expressed through a different short-haired aesthetic, and I am on board 100% for short-haired Taylor Kitsch. Oh, and I should also say Vince Vaughn, I thought was really, who is kind of the corrupt politician guy, seemed to be meaningfully torn about what he wanted to do, which is to kind of like become a grand California family and the means that he would perhaps engage in to do it, and to see both a very corrupt person and a kind of affable Vince Vaughn guy. I thought that was a very well cast part. I like Rachel McAdams.
She plays a hard-boiled detective.
Hard-boiled
who's got a past.
And
everyone seems to have a past.
She has a past and very cute underwear, Madeline, which we get to see first shot, you know.
Of course.
So, I mean, it's a show that was very criticized for its exclusive interest in the soulful gaze of men looking at sad things, and the fact that the sad thing was always something bad happened to a woman seemed to not trouble the creators of this show. The creator of the show, Nick Pizzolatto, was very defensive about that criticism, but has not seemed to move away from it, and it's just true.
So after that show debuted, HBO debuted another show, Ballers, starring
more Meryl Fantasy and
the
ladies
Rock.
In undies.
Yeah.
Yes.
And this is produced, I noticed, by Mark Wahlberg. Right, who also produced Entourage. So there's a similar broiness about this
Right,
one.
It's about ex-football players sort of managing a sports agency. And the one thing I will say is that whereas True Detective is about the real seriousness of male emotional experience, Ballers has a sense of humor about it. And so it's a lot more lively. I mean, I kept thinking about Ballers because they kept giving the preview for it before Game of Thrones. And it just was like, wow, this is clearly going to be the same story, except in cheerleader outfits instead of like long velvet gowns for the ladies. You know, it was like people kept talking about Game of Thrones is real serious. You know, it's historical realism. I'm like, it's actually, I think, the same as Ballers. Maybe, you know, maybe The Rock could make a crossover appearance. So it's even very
I would love to see The Rock on Game of Thrones.
Yeah, he could battle the mountain.
So this is just a bunch of ex-football players and their trials and tribulations trying to
make deals, live large. You know, like, it is not uncharming, and I will put up with a lot to watch The Rock, like, kind of look at you in a jaunty way. So it might not be unfun. I don't think it's going to change anyone's life.
on the USA Network, there is a show called Mr. Robot, and this is about a hacker taking on the corporation he works for. Let's listen to a clip.
It feels like all our heroes are counterfeit. The world itself's just one big hoax. Our social media faking is intimacy with our things, our property, our money. I'm not saying anything new. We all know why we do this. Because it's painful not to pretend, because we're cowards.
I think I've heard that music in a Stanley Kubrick movie. But anyway, what was this show about?
Well, it is a kind of Robin Hood as hacker sort of plot line, like this social misfit hacker. He doesn't quite fit in. He works for a computer security company by day, and by night he hacks into the networks of people who do bad things, like run child pornography rings and so forth. And he is sort of approached by a hacking ring who wants to help him bring down the big bad guys with lots of money and computers.
You're whispering because you're hoping they're not listening to you right now.
Right, because they could be watching all of the time. And the clip that we heard is the main character, who is charming, by the way, I should say. And he is actually in a therapy session with his therapist, who is a woman. Again, this is another this is like kind of gender day on the television roundup, but it's a real male fantasy about, like, I see into the truth of the world and other people don't. And there's this woman in a supportive role who said, why are you so disappointed in the world? And the clip that we heard is the answer that he gives. And while we're listening to that clip, there's footage of Tom Brady and Lance Armstrong and the Hunger Games book. You know, like, here are all of these heroes who have been false heroes. And here are all of this, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, there's a shot of that. Of like, here is all of the media that distracts us from the real problems. And here's the woman who's trying to be supportive, but totally doesn't get what I get about how dark the world is. So he takes himself very seriously, but I liked the show. It was kind of charming and it's campy. He's kind of magnetic. Christian Slater is in it, which is important news for me. He's still doing the same thing that he was doing in Heather's, which is lying around laconically and, you know, editorializing around the
world. Trying to be Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And still doing that. It's going okay for him, it seems to be like. This seems to me like there's a particular television slot that I like that's that kind of like 9 p.m. on a weekday and you don't want to think too hard, but you do want to get sucked into a story. You don't want just like kind of the one-off laugh of...
Well, yeah. Given the other two shows that we talked about, a story would be welcome.
Yes. Would be welcome for me as a television critic.
Okay. Well, are you looking forward to any releases coming up on TV?
You know, the other thing that I am starting to get sucked into now that Game of Thrones is over, you know, I was a big Game of Thrones fan, is it came out a couple of weeks ago, the new BBC on PBS show, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which is a fantasy drama about magicians in 18th century England based on a novel that I really enjoyed a few years ago. And so that... high production quality, but much less serious about itself than something like Game of Thrones, and is also sort of a rip-roaring, textured fantasy plot.
And when is that debut?
It has been out for a couple of weeks. It's on Saturdays at 9 p.m.
Okay. Sarah Mesley, thank you.
It has a story. Thank you, Madeline.
It has a story. Yay for that. Sarah Mesley, humanities editor for the Los Angeles Review of Books, where she writes for the Dear Television column. Myers is here now. Happy Monday to you.
Happy Monday. I have a story.
You have listener stories.
Because we had lots of stories today on the show.
You did.
So we led off the show today talking about the Confederate flag. Mm-hmm. Very controversial. The question at the heart of the discussion was whether the federal government should have some say over the flying of the flag, or at least that's what the GOP candidates are grappling with this week. Most of them have gone on record saying that South Carolina needs to decide the question for themselves. States' rights issue. So we put the question to listeners. Mark Schultz on Facebook says that the Confederate flag is a symbol of treason. Recall that it harkens back to that time a bunch of states decided to leave the Union. Why on earth is this symbol still tolerated? He asks. Tammy McColgan picked up on this idea of symbols as well. She says that the flag is not just a piece of cloth, it's a powerful symbol, and symbols have the power to lend legitimacy to certain ideals. especially when they're displayed near a seat of power. Come on, people. Tom O'Leary thinks that even beyond the whole states' rights issue, it's just cowardly to not go on record saying that the Confederate flag is racist. You'll notice that most of our listeners here are of a mind on the Confederate flag and the issues that we're talking about. And finally, Sean Aaron on Facebook, he pointed out a bit of history. He says that the Stars and Bars went up over South Carolina to protest school desegregation in 1961. Mm-hmm. So can we all just agree that that protest has outlived its relevance? Take it down and be done with it already.
I think ostensibly it was to celebrate the centennial of the Civil War.
Mm.
But point taken.
Mm.
All right, Jillie Myers, thank you for that. If you'd like to weigh in on that or anything you hear on the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our Twitter is at KCRW Press Play. Facebook, KCRW Press Play. We're in Olney to the Point up next at 1 o'clock. So keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.